When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Jeff. Hey, Aaron.
Hey there, you two.
Hey, heroes. And we got it. We did it.
First day. One take.
All right, everybody. Good job.
Professionals.
We are within brand guidelines.
Everyone stop recording.
We have reviewed.
Yep, wrapping it up. We're good.
Reviewed the branding packet.
Got it one. Well done. Well done, everybody.
Everyone, welcome to All My Fantasy Skyjacks, a marriage between Campaign Skyjacks, one of the best actual play podcasts out there, the world, with one of the most fun settings, with the coolest ideas and best players, and All My Fantasy Children.
None of those
the
things.
Best. The best world building and storytelling podcast out there in the world.
Yes.
There's so much power in this room right now. A term that I use loosely is no one is in the same room. And you are about to experience all of that. But first, I want to go around, make sure you know all the personalities and voices you're going to be hearing today. First up, we have Aaron Catano-Saez.
Hello, everyone. I am Aaron Catano-Saez. I am co-creator of All My Fantasy Children podcast. You may also know me. I play CeCe on Skyjack's Courier's Call.
Ba-bam. Boom. Next up, we have Jeff Stormer.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jeff Stormer. I am a podcaster, game designer, and the unofficial official LARP designer of the Olive Garden restaurant. But most importantly, I am the other co-host of All My Fantasy Children, a podcast that is good sometimes.
Well, damn.
And I will point out, because we are doing what is something akin to a plug section, that Jeff also hosts the Party of One podcast, which is not on the One Shot Network, but is extremely good.
It is.
And everyone will enjoy it.
It is. It is an actual play podcast focused on two-player role-playing experiences. If you have ever heard a show called One Shot that is also very good, it is very similar to that, except all of our games are two players. And as of today's recording, it is 6 years old in one day.
Oh, dang.
Goodness.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
goodness.
Right?
And, of course, we have Drew Merzhieski.
Hello, everyone. I'm Drew Merzhieski. I'm your host and narrator for Skyjack's Courier's Call. And other than that, I don't do much.
No, that's not true. You shut up. You stop. Don't you do that.
All right. Boys, we have a challenge before us now, a challenge that originally we promised episodes of All My Fantasy Skyjacks in connection to the Skyjacks Courier's Call Kickstarter. Now, this is a big challenge. It's a pie in the sky sort of challenge, but I would love to try and make whatever we record here able to be listened to by the Courier's Call audience. I don't know that we can do it. I don't know that we can do it, but we can say that we tried.
We absolutely
we can try.
Because
we try.
We are, you know what we are?
Professionals.
We're professionals.
That's true of three. That's true of three of the four of us on this call, but I'll give it my best.
Okay. So it's time for us to look at our chosen prompts that we have here. And the first one comes to us from Rio Reads, and it is, how do people in Sphere feel about the moon? Is it evil because of its association with the sea and its effects on tides, or is it a separate thing for them? What tales do they have about it, whether it's associated with good, evil, both, or neither? I'm going to be honest, folks. I haven't put too much thought into the moon.
Oh. I have an immediate pitch that can be shot down.
Okay.
But it is right.
The caveat is what makes it so exciting.
Ready to go.
I've got my cannons ready.
Yeah, load up the shotgun and take aim at this idea just in case.
My muskets are clean.
I want to propose a sentient antagonistic moon. Like a okay. moon that is in the sky and is and is gunning for you.
You Majora's Mask, okay. 2021.
Sure.
Jeff, you know one of my least favorite things is saying no to people.
All right, fair.
So I'm gonna point out that I'm not saying no right now, but also there's no way that can exist within the world of Sphere. That magic is too big. But what I will allow is the idea that there is a culture that treats the moon as a sentient and antagonistic thing.
Yes. So that's you said that, Jeff, and I immediately got my noodle cooking, meaning my brain. And
brain looks like a noodle.
You know, it's my noodle. It's my pasta maker.
You stretch out those little wrinkles, they're noodles, baby.
Yeah. So when I was thinking of, like, in the prompt, it says its association with the sea and its effect on the tides, you know, and all that fun stuff. I would like to posit that there are two ways of seeing it, where it is some, this culture that we might be talking about or what have you, this myth is attached to either the moon is imposing upon the sea rather than working with it by giving it a push and a pull. Mm-hmm. Or it is working with it to create a tide that lets ships traverse over it, some kind of siren-esque luring them to their doom kind of feel. But the moon having a push and pull on the sea can be seen as either one. It can be seen as antagonistic mm-hmm. or beneficial, depending on how we twist it and turn it. So it can be a myth about a being that perhaps either challenges the sea by imposing its will upon it, or, you know, is working in tandem with the mariner, the sea.
Now,
I was going to
segue immediately into the mariner as a concept, with the idea that, like, with the sea brings drowned sailors, brings the mariner, brings all of that, all of the ugliness that comes with the sea. So that the entity in the sky that pulls the sea and effectively pulls it back in a Kamehameha and hurls it at you is, I like the idea that you're describing of, like, it is perhaps, the question that comes to mind immediately is, it's beneficial, but it's beneficial to whom? And I would propose that the myth that comes with this is that the moon is beneficial to the forces in the sea that make the sea too dangerous to trod, which is to say that the moon is working in tandem, but working in tandem with those that make it so that we can't travel via the sea and have to travel via the sky.
Yeah, there are a couple ways that I can see us reflecting this. I pulled up the luminaries from campaign just to look through which luminaries I could see tying themselves to the moon. The one that jump out, that there is the tide, which is literally the thematic idea that conditions change and things change in natural cycles. You've got a high tide and you've got low tide. High tide being very dangerous and low tide being safer. There's a very obvious connection to the moon, as we do know that in our world, moon causes tidal forces. There's also the idea of the island, which, you know, that is the luminary most connected to the mariner. And that one of the things that we know about the island is that if you are sailing on the sea in a boat and you see the island, you are likely not going to be able to escape it. If it is off in the distance and you cannot see land anywhere else, you can try and sail away from it, but it will never grow farther from you. And eventually you will be forced to land on the island, where you are damned to either sink and die or live out your remaining days as a cursed drowned sailor. The idea that the moon, when it reflects on, like, dark water, can create, like, the illusion that there is a dark center at this bright spot in the water, like, I could see people, like, saying, oh, that calls the island and whatnot. So that luminary-wise, I feel like that's kind of what we're working with. The last thing I want to throw out there is I am willing to say that before the stars fell, there wasn't a moon.
That's what I was going to ask. Good. I'm sitting here just waiting my turn patiently, like, yes.
That's a wild idea. I don't know how to process it. I'm trying to decide what that would mean, like metaphysically and cosmically, but I'm open to it.
So
I'm open to this
idea. I have a thing that I want to throw out. The thing I want to propose, perhaps, hearing you talk about both the way that this connects to the island and also the tide, I want to propose that this is there's a possibility that I think is very cool that kind of pulls on both of those, maybe thematically and not literally, but like connects to those in interesting ways. What if the thing that we are building here is not necessarily a culture, but is like a place, and not quite an Atlantis, but like a location that is revealed when the tide drops below a certain, like, It is a lost thing that is revealed when the tide at a certain location at a certain place in time is low enough. You see the peaks of some ruined castle or a thing that is lost to the tide, and thus, and like it only exposes itself on these moments of safety, but it becomes a reminder of, oh, safety is sort of an illusion because that thing in the sky is going to pull the waters up and is going to... And so there is this ruined castle or island or something. There is like a ruined thing that is washed away when the tide raises and like re-exposed. And so you can visit it only when it is safe and with the constant threat that the water is going to rise up around you and bring with it all the terrors of the sea.
So this does call to a thing that we're currently grappling with in Skyjack's lore that is a major part of our story, in that we know that there is the Mariner's Island, but in addition to the Mariner's Island, there is the island where Orimar Vale was killed. That happens to be the same island where the Sovereign was killed. We know this because Orimar, you know, set up a special expedition to get to this island that is both hard to find and, you know, hard to exist there, you know, for whatever reason. And part of me thought, like, oh, there's a duality in it being hard to find, in that the Mariner's Island pulls you in, that this island might push you out. But the idea that this island is simply a thing that can be very easily hidden by the tide, so people have a lot of trouble looking for it, and even if they are able to land there, it's difficult that they'll for them to find what they're looking for, because we know Orimar went there to find the crown of the Sovereign, the literal crown of the being that was killed, which is an incredible treasure. This feels like a interesting thing for to be part of the equation.
Something that I want to step back and talk about is the idea that we are approaching this with our world's understanding of what the moon is and what it does.
Right.
And which is fun, which I love to do, which I love to also twist, though, to say, what is the moon? You know, in this case, we know that it's like a big chunk of potentially was the Earth at one point, you know, gravitates our world, has an effect because it's very large and has a pull on our world and has, you know, how physics work. However, if you can make it anything you want, I want you to really imagine yourself at night looking out at the ocean, which is a horrifying thing, faced filled with peril and monsters and like beings that wish nothing but harm on you. Imagine a giant glowing, you know, orb in the sky where its light beams up the ocean, lights your way, and...
And also it's sentient and it's coming to get you.
Yeah, and also it has legs and it's running this way. Get out of the way.
It's got a big, gross face. Yes.
It's got arms and it's swimming in your direction.
I did remember that in the Maiden and the Heart, I established that the moon is somehow the property of the Forest Queen, which I think is important to remember, because by the light of... No, wait. Is it property of the Forest Queen? It is that... The Sovereign... No, okay. So the moon reflects the Sovereign's light. Like, that is an established part of canon because the Sovereign's light cannot be seen by servants of the Queen, which is why the Changeling was not able to see the Maiden when he was hunting her. But I do think... I think it's okay. I think it's the queen owns the sun. That's right, because it was associated with summer, and the sovereign owns the moon. So yeah, like it is a former possession of a dead luminary. Oh God, I'm getting lost in the weeds here.
But either way,
I can't remember my own goddamn lore.
But either way, there is a gigantic, small planet size up to us. How big is it, James? Is it our moon, basically?
I think that's a good benchmark to start with.
And just the idea of...
Oh, maybe it's closer, so its effect on tides is more dramatic.
I think
that's
cool. I think dramatic. I think you want a big moon with big tides.
Because I wanted to, like, kind of twist the idea of, like, this doesn't have to be our one-to-one where, like, you know, yes, it creates the tides. But imagine on a full moon if it were much more dramatic in this setting where the tides, like, you know, different locales that are sunk beneath the waves, lost ships from long ago are revealed because the tide is ripped in on a full moon and shoved out in a more dramatic fashion. Perhaps.
Now, okay, can I throw out a thing about the moon that is weird and magical and but not overly magical?
Great.
Mm-hmm. What if the light of the moon is localized, or for lack of a better way? I'm imagining a sort of celestial spotlight or something like that. Like an idea of like the moon. This thing of like the moon is close and the moon is big, and if the moon is full, like it's that, you know, you said it was a reflection of the sovereign's light. It's this idea that like I picture finding things and like the moon's light having a role in like exposing things that were lost. And I think it kind of gives this idea to sailors and skyjacks of like, you know, because you and it ties into like what we think of as sailing. But like in a skyjack's context, if it is somehow larger and more celestial, and like, you know, this idea that like you follow the light of the moon both because it is where it is safest, because it is where it's brightest, but also because where the moon shines most brightly is where things may be exposed that were lost, that are no longer around.
Interesting. I like that.
Fascinating. Because you did say if it is closer and it is bright as all get out. You know, that would mean that what flying at night in the, above clouds, would that be like lit? Like, you know what I mean? For like, it would be
maybe,
be,
yeah, especially if the clouds are so reflecting
lit.
Back.
Yeah, like
it would absolutely be super lit.
But I mean, like, it would be more akin to flying during, not during the day to the same extent, but if it's bright, if it's reflecting the sovereign's light, like that's got to be a lot of light coming off that thing.
I mean, Drew, you know, when we were staying with Pat. I think it was like 2 a.m. when we were leaving his house one night, and we walked outside and it was like brighter than it had been during the day.
Yeah.
Because the snow was reflecting like the light of the clouds and whatnot.
It was eerie. It was super eerie.
And imagine that's just like the effect of the moonlight in a certain, like, and it, and like that spotlight image like sticks to me of like, it's just like a region or like an area or like a spot in the world at a certain time. And like you can kind of, in the way that you can track air currents and you can track these things, you can track these water patterns, you can track this sort of like spotlight of the moon where things are just brightened. And also with that, like there's this magical undercurrent that comes with it of simply something that was thought to not be visible is visible in the light of this. Or something that was thought to be lost to the ages is simply back.
No, that's really interesting because that also, we do have a moon market.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And the moon market, the thing about the moon market is that it connects places. It connects three places into one at one place. Like it, we could say, like you were talking about it, like it can find basically these three places at once. The moon reveals hidden things, maybe? I don't know.
Or the light of the moon can guide you towards hidden things. Like a lot of this feels like it does tie into star watching. Mm-hmm. The idea that if you have an understanding of the conditions of the world around you and the position of the stars, you will be able to navigate more clearly and even to the point where it's almost like you can look into the future because you can use this to tell the weather, to tell how crops will do, to tell all kinds of number of things. I like the idea that somebody who is an adept star watcher would be able to know where the light of the moon was. And I think really importantly, know where the light of the moon is during the day. So like, yeah. And I definitely love the folktale-esque like idea that like, yeah, one town, it might be a full moon, but the next town over, it's a half moon. And I do still love, keeping the moon with phases, because that means that, you know, under a full moon, your area, more things can be revealed within that area, which is really
and
cool.
The other, the opposite of that, which I think is also super fascinating and has a ton of potential. On a new moon.
Oh yeah, more things can be hidden.
On a new moon, things it is easier. Things are lost. Things are not just hidden, but things can be intentionally hidden, but also things are just lost. Like the moments where things are lost to the sands of time, they fall under the new moon, and it is easy if you have something to hide, whether it be a physical thing, a secret, a memory, or anything in between, you wait for the moon's light to look away, because that is when it is easiest to find a place where no one will ever find it.
And this imagery is really cool, because if we're thinking of the literal moonlight is supernatural, then yes, if it is literally the reflection of the sovereign's light, James.
So yeah, I actually have text of the document pulled up so that I can figure out how all of this works. It says it was not every night that the hart met the hunter, but it was most nights. Only on the new moon, when the dark truly settled in the queen's domain, could the hunter rest and hide. The moon belonged to the queen, but the stars belonged to the sovereign. His light fell only for his creations, and so only the hunter could see. That the other component to this is I imply later on in the story that the heart followed scent through unyielding night, and away from the reflection of silver groves, there was no light to guide him. So the silver grove tree is a wedding present given to the forest queen by the sovereign, which is this beautiful silver tree that grows typically in a ring. That is one of the sovereign's creations, but it was given to the queen. So the queen's like charge, the queen's subject, the changeling, would be able to see based on the reflection of the sovereign's starlight reflecting off of the silver groves. I think, and this hasn't been established in canon, we can establish that the moon was either created or given to the queen by the sovereign. And the moon in our world, we know, literally does reflect the light of the sun. So I kind of like that. Yeah, it being the queen's changes the quality of the light in some way.
It makes me think of a gift of not that I'm in. It makes me think of that. It's sort of like a looking glass or a mirror that reflects something to. Do you know how in a funhouse mirror, like a mirror bends light essentially? And if we're talking about kind of revealing, exposing, and potentially hiding in the darkness, I think of how a lighthouse kind of cuts through the night sky, or how a bright flashlight slices through darkness to reveal it. Perhaps this is me going on a big stretch here. If this is some sort of reflection of a supernatural light, I think of things as if you imagine the night as a desert. You know, like sands. If things can be hidden in sand, like a sandstorm comes on the new moon, covers everything up in shadow and sand uncovered. In this case, the light of the moon would therefore be able to be like pinpoint things within this sandstorm and expose it. Do you know what I'm saying? Kind of this roundabout way.
Yeah.
Is that what we're getting at? Or is this completely... Because I'm thinking of the folklore way of like, you know, on a full moon... If you go looking for things, you're more likely to find them because the world's secrets are uncovered by the reflection of this light pouring onto the world. There's nothing hide and shadow anymore.
That's where I'm at as well. That's what I'm thinking of as well. And I love the kind of visual that pops into my head. And this is sort of the silly visual with a root, like the serious take on a silly-ish visual of like the idea, almost what I'm, the visual that I almost get is like video game style indicator markers. like imagine like a Sims thing just pops up on a space of land, on a patch of dirt, and you're like, well, something is there. But like that idea that there is like something about this light that like if something is hidden and someone is searching for it, there's like a sparkle or a gleam of a plant or something that like glows in the night, that it's on the night of a full moon you go, oh, that's something that I should be looking for.
It's very akin to the pot of gold in the rainbow with a leprechaun. Yeah. Mm. Where, like, at the end of the moonbeam is, like, because, you know...
The moonbeam, yeah, the end of a moonbeam is a thing that has been hidden.
And it's been exposed because it's... If this is a deity's possession, you know what I mean? Literally going here, and it's reflecting some kind of supernatural light onto something clearly that's important that needs to be seen by the denizens who are on this planet, who are living.
And there's another wrinkle to this. This could also play a little bit into Will of the Wisplore in that, you know, there are mysterious lights that show up in forests that, like, you know, Irish myth, like, say they lure people astray and off their path. The idea is that, like, if you see something that is waiting to be found, it will appear to you as a light. Like, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Like, jives. Like, I can see that working, and I can see that being contextual to the person. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. If there are things that want to be found, maybe they are things that want to be found by specific people or something like that. But then you also have this, because this is the queen's possession, she can take advantage of this to lure people into the forest and stuff.
That's what makes it so fun, is that it involves the forest queen in this idea of control and chaos and, you know, allure. And if this, that's the person behind the wheel, potentially, the levels of, you know, as the levels of interpretation of lumens are varied, so can this idea of like a, have you ever seen when the moon like beams through a cloud and you literally see a beam of moonlight through, like during like a super moon or something? That can either be seen as a place to stay away from, because it's like, nope, the queen is maybe like, maybe the queen is exposing a secret or luring someone, and either way, I stay away from those. Or it can be seen like the rainbow and the pot of gold by some, who's like, oh my goodness, clearly some truth that I've been seeking is at the bottom of this beam.
And also, I really love the Will of the Wisp idea of like the idea that like that folklore legend of I was walking on a path and I saw like a light. You know, I saw a light that was seemingly beaming from nowhere, and a thing suddenly was, and like a section of the wood was glowing. So I walked into this bog, and like this glowing thing, like I saw this and like found some, and you know, it's the story of how I found this ring that I wear on my finger. It's the story of how I found that the mayor had been, you know, committing acts of treason and burying pots of gold in the wood. Like, it is this story that comes with this revelation of like, I saw a thing glowing, and like I walked towards it, and suddenly I was exposed to this thing. And you know, it's also the willingness to say, I am going into walking in to find this thing, because I know that there is something waiting to be found by me, and obviously it is presenting itself to me, can be a sign of death and can be a sign of true revelation.
Yeah, yeah.
And Drew, go ahead, James.
Oh, go ahead.
I have a question for Drew.
Sure.
Because if we've been talking about, you know, our understanding of this refraction of light upon this, you know, cosmic sphere that beams down onto the earth and blah, blah, blah. There's folklore around that. What does that mean for those in the sky? You know, what is the folklore around that then? You know, what is your first impulse when it comes to, because you'd have a bird's eye view of these beams, or a completely different point of view where you don't even see these, you know, rainbows to chase, essentially. What is the folklore around the magical refraction of light from a deity, for lack of a better term, against this mysterious sphere that shines light down onto the planet at night? Like, what is something about that being in the clouds?
I honestly don't think you can see it in the clouds.
Oh.
I think that once you get to an altitude, the moon disappears.
Oh!
That it's not there anymore, because the moon is only for the people on the ground.
Okay.
It's like, that's the pact. The pact is for people who are on the ground can see the moon, and if you are in the sky, you cannot see the moon
that's
anymore.
That's so good! I'm sorry, True, but that's a banger.
Thanks.
So is the moonlight still around?
I don't. Maybe it's ambient, like we saw when we came out of Pax. Like it's just brighter, but
the visual that I get. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. Go for it.
The visual that I get, I really jive with that ambient light idea, because the visual that you both threw out was walking in the snow and like having also walked in the snow and seeing like street lights make. Imagine you are in a skyship, right? Imagine you are flying. The ground beneath you, like the clouds beneath you are snow. There's snow on the ground beneath you. And like we've all seen snow, like street lights illuminated in the snow, moonlight illuminated in the snow. All you have are these brightly glowing clouds beneath you that fills the air with this visible sense. And that is an incredible, it is an incredibly disorienting thing. And it is an incredibly beautiful thing all at once that I think is really like, it's a really cool effect to be in this place that feels like it should be pitch dark, but is glowing with this sort of ambient light is sort of an amazing and beautiful visual.
Mm. Yeah, and especially because of its connection to the Forest Queen, the idea that the moon is a thing of beauty that exists for people on the ground, because in a lot of ways, the ground is the Forest Queen's domain. It might not exist on the sea. Or if it does, it's like really contextual, which is why if you are looking for an island that is hidden by the tides and can only be revealed by the moon's light, and you can't stand on the ground to see where the moon is, that makes it really difficult to find that place. That's really, really cool.
It is.
And I like that a lot.
That is fascinating.
It also means if you take enough altitude in a skyship, if you go high enough, you might actually be able to see like the effect or the pattern of moonlight across sphere.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, which would be extremely risky, and I don't even know how you could have a vessel to do it, but I can guarantee you that someone is trying. Maybe the folks over at the Ching Map Company are doing that because... Ooh.
Now, I have a big question, the big second half of the question.
Mm-hmm. With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
If this is the moon that we have established, and James, you had said it might not be visible on the sea, does the fight for the moon's light over the sea have something to do, like, does tides have something to do with the moon's light being pulled towards or closer or further from the sea? Do you know what I mean? Like, that idea of, like, if you mentioned, like, being not able to see the moon on the sky, that feels like there's a connection there that I can't quite put into words, but it feels like there's a juicy possibility for connection between that sense of the moon might not be visible to the sea, and also there are tides, which in our world are caused by the moon. There's a cool potential for some kind of connection there.
Can I tag team question that, please?
No.
Because no, I'm doing it anyway. because if the moon is a thing for those on land, yes?
Yes.
And it's, perhaps it is not visible when you're on the sea because you're not on land. Is therefore the tide itself, the motion of the ocean, is that some sort of conflict between the land and the sea? You know what I mean?
There's a lot at play here. I think a thing that I want to establish, because I think it's cool, is the idea that, well, the moon isn't visible in the sky on the sea. The moon's reflection might be, okay. Which I think is neat.
That is cool.
And we're getting to the idea of a metaphysical conflict or cycle at the point of horizon is kind of what I feel like, mm-hmm. where the land meets the sky and the sea meets the sky. Mm-hmm. There is some kind of push and pull. I do like that. And I like maybe the moon being tied up in it, but I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know what thread
maybe
is.
Maybe no
doing
one knows.
It.
Like maybe that is simply a thing that has been, maybe that is a thing that has been observed and studied and that we simply don't, you know what I mean? Like it is, cause like this feels like cheating a little bit, but I'm going to cheat to say that like, I think, and I'm being presumptuous by saying I'm speaking for what I think all four of us are feeling, but like there's a feeling of like, that feeling of there's something there, that feeling of not knowing what it is, but knowing that there's something there is so juicy to me and so compelling to me that maybe that's what people across sphere feel is being like there's a connection and I don't know what it is, but it's something.
I feel like it comes back to star watching, because like one of the underlying principles in star watching is that everything in some way is connected. That if you know and understand enough about everything, then you can get the information that you need to know and learn everything. You know, if you know the position of the stars, you can find a way to the place that you're going. If you know the position of the stars and the condition of your environment, you can tell what season is going to be, even when they flow randomly. You can tell things like weather and whatnot. I've also established that there are many different star watching traditions. There are, you know, philosophers or practitioners of star watching that have existed for a very long time and are followed by different, you know, people. Like I wrote in our magic document, which I don't know is out there, or maybe it was in the Skyjacks document, that like there are literal manuals written by historical figures within the world that explain their approach to star watching and how you can follow their approach and find success. But a lot of people find success in blending those approaches, even if they're not necessarily compatible. The idea that like you can put information into equations and get a result is like one of the paths of star watching. And there's like, there are other approaches to it. I like the idea that most star watchers, most advanced or practiced or like, you know, innovating star watchers are trying to explain this connection, trying to explain this phenomenon. And they each have a different proposal and we can't prove which one is right. It's sort of the way you talked about it, Jeff, made me think about like Einstein's desire for unification theory and like never quite getting mm-hmm. there, knowing that like there has to be something that explains everything and not being able to find it. Oh, it's very cool.
I think that is also a juicy kind of metaphor that is like handed about in folk tales, maybe among like that is handed out in folk tales is like, you know, you're chasing the bridge between land, sea, sky, and moon, right? Like it's that thing that is said when someone is obsessing over something that they're not going to find the definite, that they're not going to like. It's
you're chasing the horizon.
Yeah. It's that feeling of like it is the ultimate pursual of a folly act is trying to truly find the connection between these things, even though we all feel like there's one there.
Can I make a pitch for one? A fun one? I just had an idea. Yes. Of like a random folklore or story. Because
please.
I think of in Sphere there is kind of a clash between beings of land and sea. You know, and so sky was the way to kind of sky is the kind of thing that lets you circumnavigate it. So in this battle where land meets sea, there's always been one unifying factor, and it's the moon that kind of rises above everything and exposes both the secrets and lies and truths and joys of both of these worlds, whether or not on the sea it's ambient, but and on the land it's more bright and pronounced. still there seems to be, I would get the perspective if I were in this world, that the unifying factor is this watching, this watchful glowing orb that provides something to both of these worlds, you know, and my brain would start to churn of like, well, if on the land, you know, it's the kingdom of the four, if the kingdom of the forest queen and beams of light can lure you and beams of light can expose secrets and truths and treasures. But on the sea, it's ambient and, you know, an island would therefore be the queen's domain again, James, would it or no? Like an island, is that land or no?
It's land, but like also, is it forested?
Yeah.
Is a question.
Okay. You know? But kind of, I would think about the unifying factor in all the things that we've been discussing and stuff is the moon is there and it affects both of these two worlds, for lack of a better term. And so I would always just think about if I were a being of sphere, what it is and how it unifies these two worlds. And it's just something I wanted to posit in terms of interpretation of what the moon is to a person who just kind of has to exist in this world where the forest presents dangers, you know, the sea presents dangers. The sky is the way that we've been able to kind of avoid certain troubles and dangers and perils. But also at the center of it is when the night falls, this orb appears that, you know, has an effect on our world. And what the heck is it? That's all.
Yeah. That's great. And I feel like we are in a really good place with this where we have a more robust explanation, but also there is a lot of mystery tied into that explanation, which feels very folklore. And I like a lot. There is a late game because we're closing up on the time that we would need to move on to our next subject. The late game pitch that I want to talk through just a little bit in metallurgy and folklore surrounding metallurgy, there's a connection between the moon and silver. That's one of the proposed reasons that silver bullets are harmful to werewolves, is they've got some kind of connection to the moon. What do we think that might be like on Sphere? Do we still? I love the idea of silver still being connected to the moon. I just kind of want to play around with that.
Silver's how you travel on moonlight.
Go on.
Expand on that.
In the sense of, let us say.
No, we're done.
Done. No more. No, I think about the moon market and how the moon market is one place, is three places in one. And how it could be that they built the moon market there because there's a deposit of silver there. And the idea that places of silver connect moonlight.
That is sick.
So if you wanted to, you could make something of silver and travel on it on moonlight. Maybe, possibly. I don't know. Folklore.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I have another kind of folkloric take on silver to throw out.
Go for it.
With our powers combined.
Silver, once upon a time, like in its earliest iteration, if I remember correctly, was used for mirrors. Silver was an early mirror. Moonlight exposed.
It was actually an advanced mirror. It's sort of like the foundation of modern mirror technology.
Moonlight exposes secrets. If silver is a thing that is believed to catch the moonlight, regardless of time of day, if you look into silver, if you look into a piece of silver and you hold it up and you look at a thing behind you, that idea, the folkloric idea that may be true and may not, that you can catch the moonlight and see the things that are hidden behind you, even if it is the daytime, even if you are not where the moon is brightest, even if you are not in the full moon, you hold up that silver, things are seen in it that presents things that are missing can be found if you look into the silver of a mirror or a plate of silver or a silver object has this connection to finding things.
I like everything about what we've talked about here. I love the idea that, yeah, there is a way to make a looking glass that allows you to see more of the truth that might be normally hidden to you. There's something in the idea that a looking glass shows you a more perfect reflection of moonlight. But it's also you're seeing the reflection of moonlight. So it might be changed or distorted, even if it's more clear, which I think is fun. There's also I love the idea that the moon market works because there are silver deposits in the earth, which means that there is an extremely compelling reason for people to not mine out those silver deposits, because the silver deposits being there is what makes this place special. That really fits in with like an anti-colonial idea of, hey, you don't fuck with places that you go to.
Yeah.
It's not, the silver's not just there for you to take all of the value out of the earth. The silver's there to be, because it's part of a beautiful thing that exists within the world and makes this cool event possible. So that all extremely rules. And I just wanted to say that it rules.
Aaron, I believe, also had a thing.
Yeah. But based on what Jeff and Drew said, it makes me think that perhaps in this world, the link between the moon and silver is that what you both described was silver creating some sort of bridge or conduit to the metaphysical, to what we can't see, to the magical. You know, in the way that in our world, some people believe that crystals have a certain frequency, that there are metals that have effects, perhaps silver is best known to connect with magic or be some kind of vehicle or conductor for these things. And so it's seen as a precious metal, not because of it being pretty and things like that, because of its kind of, for lack of a better term, for you to break down magic, like reality bending effects, maybe.
Yeah, and does it have that because that's simply a good story
and
easy to believe? Does it have that because silver is, you know, of the earth and part of the bones of the earth and therefore has like its own properties? Who knows? What we do know is that it works and there's truth to it.
Now, I've got one other piece of silver folklore thinking about mirrors. Briefly.
Go for it.
I was describing mirrors. I was describing looking in mirrors and I was thinking about folklore. There's a very obvious point of folklore involving mirrors that I want to bring up in an interesting folkloric way. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. There is a very iconic supernatural presence that interacts with mirrors in a very specific way, which is you can't see a vampire in a mirror. So the idea, so perhaps there's a folklore idea that Things that if you hold up a mirror and you don't see something reflected, something is not reflected in the moonlight, like something is invisible in the mirror. If I hold it up and a thing behind me does not appear, well then that thing is not part of the pact with the Forest Queen. That is something pulled from the sea. That is perhaps something tied to this is something tied to outside of the Pact of the Forest Queen.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I think part of it could be that it is reflecting a being with spiritual existence. Mm-hmm. Because I like the idea that, you know, early on in our campaign, you might not have been able to see Orimar in a true silver looking glass because his soul wasn't in his body. But now his soul is in there. So you probably would be able to see him in a mirror.
That's cool.
But it also means like drowned sailors are like they're alive but not really alive. I really like the idea that, the mariner and his forces wouldn't be able to be reflected in
the vampire mirror thing is a thing that I think is cool, and it shows up on What We Do in the Shadows a lot, so it was on my brain.
It's very Pirates of the Caribbean with those with the moonlight affecting the skeleton sailors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we're about. We're aiming for that Pirates of the Caribbean energy. Folks, I think with that statement, we have made a lot of progress vis-a-vis the moon. The moon has a lot more oomph, a lot more narrative to it. And I thank you all. We are going to move on to our next prompt.
Dang.
And I hope our listeners enjoyed this exploration of the moon, our friend, the moon.
Health to the strangers who've ever been kind, and once for our friends ne'er to rise. Twice to the dearest we're leaving behind, who know we can never deny the call of the sky.
We got to do the regular All My Fantasy Skyjacks intro. So I think that starts with Aaron and Jeff, actually.
Oh, yeah. Did we start with hey?
Drew, we do need to tell Drew what to do.
Yeah, I don't know.
So you are going, like, they're going to do the normal All My Fantasy Children introduction. I think you're very quickly going to catch on what that is.
Okay. And yeah, you'll be fourth in line, so just follow what James does and you'll be fine.
I'm going to go with fourth in line,
okay.
Because mine is different than everybody else's.
Ooh.
So Drew,
I'll be third.
Drew,
I'll do
we
it.
Just we're testing your improv skills
so,
here.
Cool. Yeah, we'll do a thing and you can fill in the third word with whatever you like, but we're going to ask you to say three words once Aaron and I cue each other up.
Three words.
Beautiful.
All right. Yeah.
How excited are you
right.
to...
Two
to
words. There's two words.
How excited are you to start with a riddle?
I know.
It's going to be great.
An enigma.
In the universe of Starwall Odyssey, space is made out of the collective imaginations of all the thinking beings who live on various planets. These worlds are connected to each other through imagination. Common themes and ideas are strings between universes. And to get between them, people fly wooden ships that look like animals, which are powered by emotions. Also, people communicate with each other by contemplating orbs. The only way you can take pictures is getting stared at by a big psychic bug. And people have already declared victory in a war over the very concept of evil. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Starwall Odyssey follows the adventures of the hapless inhabitants of the Lucky Finn tenement building, who suddenly find that their apartment is actually a spaceship, and that they're lost in a sea of boundless imagination. It's an actual play starring me, James D'Amato, Mel D'Amato, Ali Grauer, and Drew Merzieski, as we playtest the No Kings system, which will hopefully one day be the Skyjacks role-playing system. It toes the line between weird and wonderful slice of life and high-flying space fantasy. You can sample the first 5 episodes by searching for Starwall Odyssey on your favorite podcast app, or get the whole thing by heading to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast and signing up for $5 a month or more.